Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
People,
this is, can you hear me? Yep. Well, what's up, people?
I can hear you. You just can hear vaguely. Me. Were you swimming underwater when
No.
What's
up, people? This is the Reverend Spiro, and this is Eating Disorder.
Nice. I just started reading Aquaman. I feel like, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Really? Maybe I just don't hear myself loud enough in my own mind.
I mean, this week we don't have the Reverend Paul. I'm sorry, I'm the Reverend Spiro. We don't have Chef Paul, but we do have Crazy Legs
Scotty. I like the 2 minutes in, the whole thing has just gone south.
Oh,
Eating Disorder, season three. Yeah, episode three or four.
It is what it is. It's becoming the Uncle Floyd show of internet radio. You know, sooner or later, we're going to have Oogie here going, you know, you suck, I hate you.
Well, I liked earlier when we were not backstage, but in the garden of Roberta's, where you were saying, you know, last week we had little Jimmy, who's a little person on, but we're on a podcast, and what was humorous to all of us in the studio was that he ate a Caesar salad throughout the entire podcast, maybe not understanding that the microphone would pick up that kind of chewing cud noise. And he just kept saying, that salad was a home run. And I'm just like, all right, let's focus on the topic, little Jimmy. And you were saying we do things that are maybe too visually stimulating.
No, but then we're going to keep doing that. We're going to have a mime.
I like that. I know
stripper.
A mime. A stripper. And I think we should get... you said a ventriloquist,
yes.
Which is sort of auditory. But and then I thought your astute comment was we could redo the Warren Zevon song and have it be mimes, ventriloquists, and strippers. You know,
send mimes,
ventriloquists, and strippers. You can't hear us on the air or something. Yeah, we could. I think we could do that. But so, yes, so Chef Paul is away at the moment. I was away last week.
Mm-hmm. And you were across the pond.
Yes. Hello, Governor. I had an amazing time. So my purpose in going, having only been to England once for 30 hours, which would take up a podcast in itself to talk about, I did a Morgan Spurlock show over in England. One of the guests was Jamie Oliver, who was incredibly cool and unpretentious.
Awesome dude.
My favorite celebrity chef.
Yeah.
And I didn't really get the full... I did get an amazing English experience. I was just on the BBC stages all day, and then I went to the Savoy with Morgan, and I was wearing shorts. I wear shorts year-round. The maitre d' was like, oh, you're a guest of Mr. Spurlock's. I will accommodate you. And he went and got his backup pair of tuxedo pants, which I put on over my shorts. And, like, the Savoy, they kicked out Jay-Z. They wouldn't let him in. So that experience was amazing, and everything does look very regal. I was in a black cab. And I said, oh, what is that? Is that where the queen lives? And the guy was like, that's a department store.
We're in a black cab?
No, like I was pointing to a building. But this trip was for 5 days. And the purpose, I have a short film called Tiddlywink that I wrote and directed that Little Jimmy is one of the leads in. And it got into one festival only, called Rain Dance. And I went over and it premiered on the Tuesday night, September 30th. I flew out all night, got in. I had booked, I wanted to spend all my money on fish and chips and pub beer. So I booked a 10-bed mansion, $30 a night. Yeah, I didn't realize it's actually 10 beds, not like just one bed for me and then nine for random strangers. And they wouldn't let me check until 2 o'clock, so I had to run around. I had an English breakfast, and then I did eat fish and chips for 3 days straight. I ate maybe like 9 to 11 fish and chips.
There's worse things
to eat. It was amazing, and the best came from our former producer Orla Clark's recommendation. I ate the seashell on Lisson Park, and it was unbelievable. And the other thing they have is mushy peas. Do you know what mushy peas are?
I hate peas, but
no.
Go ahead.
Listen, you hate peas because you pick them up with a fork or a knife.
No,
they roll off. They have the consistency of a deflated volleyball.
It's the sweetness of them. I'm not a fan of them unless they're done in a very certain way. Like, I could have them in a shepherd's pie. That's pretty much it.
All right, here's the thing. You've had vino. You've had wine. You realize that's been grapes that are just crushed. So these are peas that are crushed, not pureed. Sometimes they're minty peas. Some of them are a little more baby food.
Wow, you said baby food. That's what I was thinking. This is not making it better.
They were so good. They were so good. It's my new favorite vegetable, my side dish. And then I ended the trip. So I'd done all fish and chips, minty peas, mushy peas. And I went to a Jamie Oliver restaurant, Barbacore, okay. which he started with Adam Perry Lang, who cool. I used to work with in New York. So both meat-centric guys. And this was a steakhouse. And I know that we've maybe talked about it on the show, but nose to tail is a big thing to eat.
Yeah, eat everything.
I started with the pig's cheeks, and my main course, one of two, was the rump.
The jowls.
Yeah. So okay. The rump, ass, and it was really...
I mean, did you get to the sphincter? I mean, that's the part.
It was the best ass I've ever eaten, even counting a few college years that, experimentally. So I felt like I got the great. I could have done like the 70-quid steak.
So you got both cheeks.
Got both cheeks, and then I had the pork chop. I ordered four appetizers, two main trays, three desserts, and that was lunch. And that was like a 2.5-hour lunch. And then I went out that night. And I passed this place called the Jugged Hare.
Okay.
And it's a conglomerate, which doesn't sound as good.
The Jugged Hare.
It's a type of rabbit.
Yeah.
And they have them stuffed in the windows, hanging.
Okay, they're not like pickled eggs. They're not jugged. They're not actually
Not. Although, you know what? They had their a lot of wild fowl. They have game birds in the jugs. And they say, this is what we have, not only in if this is in season, it's on the menu. It was a display of taxidermied birds. So the menu is like, oh, we're out of wood pigeon. You can have the red grouse. You can have the... And I was like, this is amazing. I ate... like Noah's Ark, he let on two animals, two by two. I basically ate like half of Noah's Ark in the course of an afternoon and evening. So
really?
I had a really, really good trip. And I sightseed, I jogged, I saw things and drank things, and I really enjoyed it.
You didn't get into much detail about the premiere. How did the premiere
go? Well, the festival's very sprawling. Like the New York Academy of Film. I think they do a lot of education. So I didn't actually meet a lot of people other than in the program was – actually, this is a good question for you. So the program was called Pulp Fiction. It was largely all the short films with like nudity, male and female, loud music, punks and violence. Dick Kraft, am I saying that right? A gentleman who maybe passed away fairly recently. He made a punk film that had like Agnostic Front music and all this stuff. There was a lot of nudity, a lot of death, a lot of sex. It was basically a porno film. And I was onto my fourth like Cronenberg beer by that point, so it hit perfectly. And it was great. It's nice to see the film on a big screen. I knew that a UK audience, of which there were people, would appreciate it more than an American audience, say, perhaps. And then I hung out with the Belgian filmmakers and these girls who I think one was like 18, one was 20, and the film ended, and I was like, well, what do you guys want to do? Like thinking, oh, we're going to go to a coffee shop and talk about movies. And the girl was like, I want to get drunk. And I'm like, what's the drinking age? She's like, in Belgium, it's 16. Oh. I'm like, what's the drinking age here? She's like, 18. I'm like, let's go get drunk.
Yeah.
But most pubs close at 11, so we found our way to a fake Irish bar. Somehow, anywhere I go in the world.
A fake Irish bar?
Well, it's not in Ireland, so it's like it's a fake Irish bar. I've been to fake Irish bars I've been to fake Irish bars in Guam.
We've got a lot of them in New York.
Slante. We do. So I hung out with them, and I had no jet lag because I just didn't sleep. And it was great. So I felt like I got the film festival experience. And then I forgot to pick up the elements. I couldn't find the DCP and the Blu-ray, so I think they have to mail it to me. They have to post it, as they say. But I really loved...
And you'll be able to see it on our Facebook page.
Yeah, no, you won't.
Not yet.
Facebook
or
doesn't
not.
Allow nudity. But we'll probably have a screening, a cast and crew screening. And
we could always put up the link and let people deal with it.
No, I will let... people come to the cast and crew screening, which will probably be Two Boots Pizza.
Excellent.
And that's
because we love Two Boots.
Absolutely.
Well, this week's show is going to be about kind of like surviving in the wild. I mean, we've done shows about foraging, and we've eaten bugs on this show. We're going to have our friend Hazen Audel on the show, who is the host of Surviving the Tribe, which on Nat Geo, but that's in the UK, but it looks like it's coming here to the United States. But, I mean, a couple of the things about just surviving in the wild. Look, I was a Boy Scout. You know what Boy Scouts taught me? How to roll a joint. They taught me
so
how
get,
to.
You get a merit badge for that?
Yeah,
you know, spliff I got, rolling?
Yeah, we learned how to roll joints, how to hide, vodka in a Gatorade bottle and take
goodness.
It with us.
I didn't know where you were going with that. Hide the.
Yeah, we learned how to pitch a tent. Oh!
All right, so. Well, I was only a Cub Scout. I had a Cuban woman as the den mother, and she was. Her son was in there. Her son was a pale, sickly kid. She was like the size of like an offensive lineman. So I was just intimidated. So I got out before I became a boy. I remain a Cub to this day.
The whole thing about camping, though, I mean, it's always been an issue for me. First of all, I'm not necessarily poo shy. I mean, I'll talk about poo all the time, and I've taken.
You're only talking about poo because Chef Paul is not here.
No,
yes,
yeah,
go ahead.
This is my
free reign. This is the poo show.
It's the poo moment. Okay, so basically, I mean, I've pooed in Mars Bar, and that's a hostile environment.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
But pooing,
people now think that's a candy bar, but that used to be the claim to fame was the most decrepit bar on 2nd Avenue and 1st Street.
Didn't have a toilet seat.
It was amazing. Yeah. It barely had a toilet. I mean, it was like a hole in the ground.
But pooing in the wild, and I've been out there, right, is like I get poo shed because I'm afraid a bear is watching.
Okay.
You know, and like I don't want to like offend the bear.
Becomes voyeuristic?
It's just, you can't poo. It's you ever go to Mars Bar at least had a curtain.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
But in the wild, they have trees. Those are nature's curtains.
Kind of.
So it's not so much. In other words, I babysit a kid who doesn't. He's five. He doesn't like to poo at school, which I think is a common thing.
Mm.
So he waits till like we leave, and then we go to Crif Dogs, and then we go to the donut place and Oddfellows Ice Cream. Like it's a three poo trip on the way home. And I wanted to write a kid's book called "It's Okay to Poo at School," but that's all I have is the title. But so you feel that it's in the woods is
it's
where
hard. And, well, think about it this way: if you're prepared, you've brought enough toilet paper. If you can't poo or whatever, otherwise it's leaves.
Leaves, yeah, you know, and you I can mean, go wrong. I mean, poison ivy, poison oak.
Yeah. I've had some terrible experiences while camping, and I have camped.
Uh-huh.
One time, a porcupine stole my boots. It actually happened. They like salt. I have salty Greek feet.
Uh-huh.
You know, they love the
and
boots.
And they just carry one just, porcupine just, or a whole
was,
family
no,
just carried
it was
off.
No, one giant fucking planet-sized porcupine.
And
it
you
was
saw
amazing.
This happening,
yeah,
but you were afraid to act.
He just came over and said, "I'm grabbing your boots." And I'm dragging him
away.
Like, what do you do?
And did you seize up, or did you feel like that was the moment you had to poop? Like, was it a fear poop?
No, the poop was gone, but the thing was the boots were gone, too.
I think what you should have done is laid down a poop to distract him, like a circle of poop around your boots.
If it was a salty poop, he would have liked it.
Oh,
he liked salt, like I said.
All right.
You know? But, look, honestly, at the end of the day, I am about...
I shudder to think if anyone important at Heritage Radio Network is listening at this point, when they tune in, they're like, what is this? Porcupine poop show? But go ahead, keep going. All right.
Well, look,
so you feel that the toughest part of living in the wild is the pooping portion.
No, I can't live in the wild. There's no I'm not built for it. If I don't have hand sanitizer and 24/7 food delivery, I'm useless.
I think I could live in the wilderness, but last night I had this moment at 3 a.m. leaving a bar going, you know, why are there no good cheesesteak places on 2nd Avenue? I have to go to 1st Avenue. Like, I have to go over 1 Avenue to get a cheesesteak at 3 a.m., yeah.
Dude, there is no way I'd be able to survive in a wild.
So you couldn't go off the grid?
No.
You couldn't be dropped somewhere?
Bugs, okay, you know that scene in
Temple of Doom?
No. That's a good one, but... The Stephen King
nine and
movie
a half
with
weeks.
The kids with the leeches.
Stand By Me.
Stand By
yeah,
Me.
Yeah.
That scene with the leeches, I'll do beaches. I'll do the sea.
Leeches are kind of... I don't know anybody who...
But lakes
other than
and
like
ponds.
A 1900s doctor who really likes leeches.
Yeah, but lakes and ponds. I just won't do them.
The issue with pool or pond, would be bad for you, but is that when you're walking in... Like beaches, you get the rocks.
Yeah.
Really cut up your feet. Ponds, you get that weird squishing,
yeah.
Like you're almost in, like it's a combination of horse manure and pesto.
And leeches.
And leeches. All right, so you don't like leeches. So you feel our guest tonight may be able to shed some insight onto how you, a man who can't live without 24-hour food delivery and hand sanitizer, could live in the woods.
Dude, our guest drank milk and cow's blood. I'm pretty sure he can give us a lot of insight.
Because that was all that was available. Or that was at...
No, that was part of the show. It's basically he was living with XYZ Tribe.
Okay.
And that was part of their game.
I can't tell you how many mornings I wake up when I'm like, you know, I don't really feel like orange juice. But there aren't too many mornings I'm like, you know, I could go for a nice milk and...
Blood smoothie.
Was it? I still don't know. Was it Laverne or Shirley who used to drink the Pepsi and the milk? This sort of takes it to a new level.
It was.
This is like Squiggy. What Squiggy would drink?
Wait, okay. Which one was Laverne? Which one was Shirley?
I can't remember. Penny Marshall and
Shirley was the bossier one, wasn't she? She drank the milk and the Pepsi.
Okay, so that was Penny Marshall then.
Yeah, all right. Or was that Laverne?
You could now. So you're in the woods. You're drinking. With
but
Penny
see, that's the problem. I wouldn't be in the woods. That's the thing. It's really the whole idea about getting off the grid for me.
Right.
It would have to be a sand beach, right? Which, considering the fact that our beaches are shrinking and we're becoming flood happy all the time.
Okay.
It would be stupid in the first place, but it would have very few bugs.
Okay.
You know, like ants, bees.
Do you think you could survive? Now, this is we're in a retrofitted, repurposed. Shipping container that's mostly made of wood. It's got a hunting lodge vibe. It's got a boar's head.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw Liz, our engineer, taking what appeared to be a beer from a secret hiding place. So I now know I'm staying for 3 weeks. Forget the woods. I'm staying in here because apparently there's beer and we get pizza delivery.
So when the shit hits the fan, we'll go back to tribalism. Right. We're all coming back to Roberta's.
Oh. Now, I often wonder, I like being dropped in foreign places. I don't have a cell phone. I own a typewriter, a carrier pigeon, an abacus, but I like carrying maps, although I have a terrible sense of direction. So I like the notion of being dropped somewhere and having to figure it out. But generally, my scenario is not like survive in the wild or be in the desert. It's sort of like get dropped somewhere where I can find the nearest dive bar and a slutty girl can give me a hand job.
All right, there's that. All right,
so,
there's
but this
that.
Is not
I
mean, what
I
we're
have
talking
to be,
about.
I have to be like at least a mile away from a Cheeto.
Okay, fair enough.
It's
fair
like
I was thinking you seem like the kind of person who could argue that processed food is made in a sterile laboratory versus people who eat vegetables that are found in the dirt, right? I mean, who wants to hang out in the dirt?
Okay, look, here's the thing. I go to my farmer's market. I'm trying to be healthier.
Right.
But at the same time, I do acknowledge the fact that processed food is what created civilization, believe it or not, as we know it. If it wasn't for the fact...
Processed food.
Well, no, not processed food as we talk about it today.
All right, okay.
All right, the fact that you can freeze food.
Okay, all right. That's how sushi took over the world because... it's true. The empty planes were... flying from Japan, we would send planes over, and once they got refrigeration on planes,
refrigeration.
They started sending,
that's the thing, refrigeration, things like that.
Everything in the old days without refrigeration was salted beef, salted whatnot. Do you think historically they had a lot more porcupine problems?
No, maybe they had a lot more pork problems.
Because
salt pork is not gonna. I don't know. The whole thing about like raw pork is like.
Well, you saw me earlier. I did have a lime in my seltzer at the bar, so I would avoid scurvy.
Yes.
So I do think like I'm in the 1900s. So I'm ready. I'm ready to go to the wilderness.
All right, folks. Lizzie Widows. We're going to go to break for a second. I'm going to bring back our. We're going to bring back our guest. Our guest Hazen Audell. Thanks so much for stopping by.
We'll be right back.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hey, what's up? This is John Norris, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
And we're back.
We are.
Mr. Rev Spiro, I'm here with Crazy Legs Conte, and we're going to introduce our guest. He is the host of Surviving the Tribe here in America and in the UK on Nat Geo. Hazen Odell is a TV presenter, a biologist, a natural history guide, a public speaker, an artist, and a craftsman. You are the type of man that my girlfriend will leave me for.
How are you, sir? Do you have one of those titles that you prefer over all the others?
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know if that one was a compliment or not. I'll take it as a compliment. But I just got fortunate in life to just do what I love to do. That's it.
And part of what you love to do is to go and hang out, so to speak, with indigenous tribes and to basically blend in, so to speak, with other people and have these interesting experiences, to eat interesting things, and then come back and explain it to the rest of the world who, you know, we talked to the first half of the show. We live in a very easy city, New York City, mm-hmm. to deal with 24 hours. We're not exactly in the wilderness here. But would you say that's a fair assessment of your show and your lifestyle?
Well, I'd say that I get to... I definitely have found that I started traveling right when I graduated from high school, and that sort of zest for exploration never left me. And just the scenarios that I've put myself through it's something that I don't ever want to live without. So, yeah, it definitely has become a lifestyle, something that I'm going to try to get myself in this as many of those sort of situations as possible.
Hey, Hazen, the one thing, this is Spiro. The one thing I noticed is that you're part Native American and part Greek. Hey, so we're about to go through this. We're homeboys, you know? And the one thing, I just got to ask you this. See, I have this, like, image of you and your family. Like, you've got your Native American background that's saying, yes, we're grounded with nature and our background. And then you've got the Greek part that's going, why can't you be a doctor like your Uncle Nick?
Yeah, I think I come from a sort of a motley bloodline. And I've got a lot of different tricks in my survival kit that helped me along. So, you know, it's nice to have a background with Native American stuff. And I'd say my dad, he is the epitome of, well, if you've ever seen the movie My Greek Wedding, that's my family.
Okay.
So I've got some serious family support backing me up, but they've always kind of let me do my own thing, so I've been lucky in that way.
Yeah, well, we'll start a support group. I'll meet you there. I'll be like, why? Why do you do this to your mother? Why?
Where did you grow up?
My mom only watches. She watched, I think, the first two episodes, and she hasn't watched any more, actually. Right.
That's a compliment, then. That's good. Where did you grow up? Where were you based as a kid?
Well, I grew up in a little small town, and I still live here in Spokane, Washington, right on the outskirts. And I live here because of sort of the My Greek Wedding thing. I've got an amazing family and sisters with a whole gang of kids and mom and dad and grandma. And, you know, this is where my roots are. It's a nice place to live. But believe me, when I get an opportunity to leave my hometown, I'm out.
And then you go and you basically create another family elsewhere. And that becomes a temporary family for about how long are you embedded with different tribes?
Well, the show says, I mean, just to kind of keep it linear, they say I'm there for 10 days, but I'm usually there for about 3 weeks. Uh-huh. And probably the most difficult part, well, of filming the series is just because, you know, you're living with the families, you know, you're getting to know the kids, you're eating their food, you're waking up with them, you're doing all that, you're doing all of the chores that they do, and along the way, there's all these kind of, I mean, sincerely, life or death situations. And so by the time you leave, It's like leaving a family, and it's, I think for all of us, it winds up being a tearjerker, and you're just kind of left with wondering, how are you going to be able to return back to this place?
Yeah, but I mean, I never left my family where I drank cow's blood and went on shark hunts. That's the big difference. You know? I mean, what I want to know is when it came down to it, right? Honestly, how rough did it get? Were there any situations? You've been in the Arctic, you've been in the Kalahari, you've been in in remote islands in the Pacific. I mean, has there been any situation where it was like, man, I won't do this, man? I'm in trouble. Anything that was like any anecdote that you could be like, wow, I was not prepared for this.
Well, fortunately, you know, I've kind of been doing this sort of stuff. Like I said, I've been traveling since I was 19, but I've been kind of doing my own thing since then. And it's kind of like one of those things when you've experienced, like if you've ever climbed a huge mountain and you thought you were going to die the entire time and then you survived it. And you hated climbing the whole time, but when you're back home, all you want to do is climb another mountain. And that show is kind of like that. I've had a lot of experiences in my life that have just kind of given me a tough skin and have allowed me to really understand my limitations. But for sure, I think on every episode, you know, you're doing, for a lot of these guys, just getting food is a life or death situation, and you're kind of thrown right in there. So you don't necessarily know what the outcome is, but you're ready to charge, I suppose. Helps out a lot.
Let's run down maybe some of the tribes you've been with. If you could just give us a quick description, and then what was the strangest thing that you ate with them? I mean, we have a few we know from your show and stuff, but if you want to just start anywhere and tell us a tribe and then what you ate, that'd be great.
Oh, well, if you're interested in the food, I would say let's go from, well, okay. For one, I was really hungry today.
Okay.
And I was thinking, God, you know, I remember this one time when I was in the Solomon Islands, and I had this great woman that was taking care of me while we were shooting, and she was kind of like my host mom. Mm-hmm. And she was like my mom. I mean, she made sure that I was fed, you know, and she was making sure that I was cooking my fish properly that I caught, and every morning I'd wake up and she'd have this amazing bowl of fruit there are these kinds of fruits that you've never seen before in your life. And I, you know, there's no names for them in English. And,
okay.
And that goes from probably, I'm going to go from the best to maybe the worst,
okay,
I would say. So that was really good. Very tasty food.
And are these fruits, like, are they closer to, are the fruits closer to, like, jackfruit or durian or rambutan? Are they look like things from Avatar, or are they, could we understand them in, like, basic fruit?
Now, they're, okay, let me try to explain it. There was this one fruit. It was called mangat, if you can explain it.
Okay.
That's how it's called.
You could say
it's
anything you want on our podcast.
And it was this mixture of, like, mango, raspberry, and, like, a hint of onion.
Really?
It was really bizarre. But
Dole has been working on that flavor for years. They haven't got it right. But that sounds pretty
Monsanto
good.
Monsanto does it every week,
yeah.
But they, you know.
So that was the best. That was that fruit. Okay.
There's no Skittles flavor for that yet. Get them out to the Solomon Islands, and they'll have a whole new bag of flavors.
Well, nice. Okay. Well, go ahead, man.
So there's that, and then, of course, when you're living with, like when we were in Kenya living with the Samburu, I mean, in the show, if you watch the show, I mean, honestly, I was there for 3 weeks. The only thing I had to eat was milk and blood from cows. And that, I will say, I never got used to.
Is that, that's obviously
really
the protein and the iron? Is
what's that?
The nutrients are for the protein and maybe the iron and things. But how would you describe that taste?
Well, it was an interesting just sort of experiment that I put on myself, because we're not just eating that just for the show. That's honestly what the warriors live off of for almost 10 years.
Wow. Okay.
So it's crazy to think that their diversity of food is very limited because, I mean, just the conditions out there, they can't grow food. There's not a lot of wild vegetables and things like that. So they have developed a way to live off of their cows, and by doing that, they bleed their cows and they milk their cows.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but it is honestly, I can remember the first time I had the blood. I mean, it's like drinking a huge glass of warm bloody nose.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm gonna not try that. That being said, though, you do have a couple of great quotes on a couple of different websites that we were looking at, and I'm paraphrasing here, but you were talking about survival. Look, if the shit hits the fan, environmentally, socially, politically, people are gonna have to survive off their wits. I mean, one of the things I saw that you said was something about trying to fix your mobile phone in the Arctic while you have a lighter in your back pocket. You know, do you have any advice for, you know, some of our listeners? One Bill in Arizona, that's our only listener, you know, and to see if
he loves us, though.
Oh, yeah, he loves us. He loves us. He, if Bill was stuck, you know, in the Arctic, for example, I mean, what are some of the just basic things? If you're stuck, you're camping, you get screwed, you turn your ankle. It's the things you need to do to be able to survive for a little while.
Well, I mean, I honestly believe that the guys that I'm with that I'm learning from and Survive the Tribe, those guys are the true heroes. I mean, they have been perfecting this way to survive in their environments for, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years. All that knowledge has been passed down. So you got to hang out with local knowledge. You know, there's all these survival shows where, like, yeah, I'm going to go out and do it by myself. So that's just like surface. It'll get you through, but it's not going to enable you to actually thrive out there for a long time. So you got to learn from the best. And so if you can utilize local knowledge, that's kind of where it's at. And you're getting so much more of the experience, too.
Plus, you have somebody to brag to. Like, I made it another day, you know, as opposed to talking to yourself.
So I know where
volleyball.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no but, fun. Like,
but in New York, that means I know where the deli is.
Right. Like I actually, you know, while you were talking, I realized the first thing I read when I graduated college, right after graduation, I read the short story by Jack London called To Build a Fire.
Okay.
And so it's basically the story of a guy whose dog realizes that he and the dog are not going to make it back. And he's building a fire, and he forgets that he builds it underneath a overhanging tree that is covered with snow, and the snow melts. The fire melts the snow hits the fire, goes out, and he just starts running because he knows he's going to die. So it seems like there is a logic to things you want to do when you're out there and things are bleak. And obviously we've seen – you're right. We've seen a lot of the single guy, you know, 127 hours – it seemed like that movie took 127 hours to make it through. But, you know, those types of scenarios get a lot of publicity. But really, I kind of like your experience, which is a little more collective. I mean, living on milk and cow's blood for 3 weeks, you have to adapt to, I guess, not masticating. You have to adapt to, you really have to become a local.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. I would say that, I mean, doing exactly, I mean, it's arduous. It's a demanding environment. You got to herd those cattle, and you got to bring them up mountains and everything, and
you got to hunt,
and they don't take breaks.
Places.
But I would say it's amazing food because I had energy for that whole time, and I know exactly what I was eating.
Yeah.
So, except I will say also, I was just hungry. You know, you're used to having something in your gut, you know, but so you get used to that. But within time, I got more used to it too. But it wasn't as if I was craving to have a big glass of milk and blood by the end of the day. That's all that was there.
And have you looked into, have you ever been embedded or looked into being embedded in a cannibal tribe?
We have a little bit of a, we obsess about cannibals on this show, by the way. You know.
it is an interesting subject, and well, between you and I, but I guess this is a radio program, you wonder what different people taste like, you know?
Well, there you go. See? I'm glad you said it. I've read Alive by Piers Paul Reid several times, and there's nothing that doesn't come with a recipe index in the back. And there's another book called Now the Hell Will Start. Brendan Croner wrote it about an American POW, or not POW, American escapee, the largest then manhunt of a black soldier who escaped because he had insulted and shot at his white officer, and he lived with the Naga tribe, which was a cannibal tribe, and he became part of their ceremonies, and he certainly ate, you know, long pig. I've eaten hufu, which is human tofu, which is a vegetarian option for cannibals, but I'm with you. You look around, I mean, once you settle down and you're married and or you have a steady girlfriend or boyfriend and you go to a bar, I like the idea of not looking around going, oh, that girl's hot, or, you know, that guy's really attractive. I like the idea of going, wow, that guy's a little too lean. I don't think I would. Maybe filet. Or maybe a nice.
Oh, check out the calf on that
guy. Oh, what a carpaccio I could make out of that. So, but you've yet. Is that something that producers of the show or people are saying, like, this would take it a little beyond? Or is that something you have no interest in doing? You don't have to say you're going to eat humans.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to wrap in our day and time. It's hard to wrap. People have a hard time wondering about what people taste like these days. You try to keep it to yourself. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, it's so unfortunate. Television is becoming so sensational, and you're being pressured to do all these things. But life is amazing enough, and you don't need to do all these trivial things.
There
you
go. That's a perfect answer.
If it came down to it, and I'd have to. Well, we'll see. But I don't think it's going to happen on Survive the Tribe. That's for sure.
I want to go. We haven't really talked about the Arctic at all, and I want to get into that one. What was that like? I mean, one of Bourdain's books. He talks about, you know, eating whale blubber and all that, and I mean, what was. My thing is, I'm always worried about heat. Like, I always say, like, oh, I could probably survive in the cold, but I probably couldn't survive past, you know, 37th Avenue in Jackson Heights if I didn't have a couple of bucks in my pocket. But the truth is, I mean, what is it like being out in the cold, being out in that particular environment and having to survive year after year?
Well, you get in those environments. We shot two cold weather episodes. One was in Mongolia, and one was in the Arctic. And in both two of those locations, I mean, it's not like it's a place where you can go pull a carrot out of the ground. It's just solid. It's either snow or it's solid sand.
Uh-huh.
And so those people are eating meat, basically meat products of all kinds. And so when I was in the Arctic, we weren't very fortunate, and we tried our luck with hunting for seals, because that's the primary thing that they were eating at that time, and we were unlucky. So if you see the episode, basically we had to go to a really desperate situation, go under the ice and go get mussels, but that's a whole nother story later. But I'll tell you about the food in Mongolia. Should I go there?
Okay, so
Mongolia, those guys, they're able to live out there because they've been able to domesticate their animals to live in those areas, right? Mm-hmm. So they have these specialized sheep that live in this very cold environment. They're sheep, camels, horses, and cows. And so they're living off of those animals. Mm-hmm. And when I was there for 3 weeks, there was not a single thing beyond the color of beige and brown. It was all meat. Everything was meat. And it was just so cold there that in the morning you just take 3 spoonfuls of butter and you either put it in your tea or you just eat it like ice cream.
That really appeals to me.
Yeah. We're like now we know where Atkins spent his summer vacation. But after a while, like, I just need a broccoli tree.
Oh man, I tell you what, yes. Anything on the opposite color spectrum would have been amazing. I would just fantasize about something like a tomato. Sprouts? Oh my God, just a sandwich of sprouts, yes. But instead, it would be these plates of like, they called it cheese, but you would eat it, and it was so hard. It was about the size of a golf ball, and you try to find maybe a weakness, like a fissure in it for your teeth to break through. It was so hard.
A product
and
not coming from
like
Kraft.
Really sour yogurt.
Soon.
There was that.
They called it cheese. I want to see
that.
I want to see that product like on American shelves in supermarkets. They called it cheese, just like a.
What do the animals eat then? I mean, they're not eating. They're not feeding the
animals
beef. I mean,
They are eating. They are eating animal products like fat, and those are the calories that you need to keep yourself warm.
Huh.
I'll tell you the craziest thing I ate though. I wish the camera was there, but you know, you're hanging out with the family. The crew's not there. And I woke up one morning, and they busted out with this plate. And I couldn't quite identify what it was, and there's a little bit of a language barrier. And from my knowledge of basic knowledge of anatomy, it looked like a stomach. Okay, so it's a stomach, okay? Mm-hmm. So I've had, like, tripe and stuff like that, but this is a stomach. And they sort of cut it up in slices like they're going to cut up a roll of cinnamon bread. And what was inside it just looked like, I like looked at it and I smelled it and I sort of touched it. It looked like butter. It looked like it was a stomach just full of butter. Like, and I was like, no way, that can't happen. There's no way.
And was then, it stomach you know, or was it colon?
You try to use all your senses to assess. Yeah. So I'm smelling it, and it smells like a horse. Like it smells like you're riding a horse. It's a horse. Boy. And I was like, there's no way in hell that this is going to be a better filled horse stomach. Serves cold, like right. No way. And that later on, one of the guys from the community that spoke English, and we're like chowing down this thing. They're they're loving it. I'm like just choking it down, and I'm like, what is this that they're eating? And they just keep giving me slices of, and they love it. And they're like, oh yeah, that's butter-filled horse stomach. I was like, whoa.
Wow.
Oh, holy cow. And, there it was. And they loved it. All and, right. That sort of food keeps them alive. But, yeah, that was one of those times where I was really craving, like, an amazing, amazing garden deli sandwich.
A radish.
We will keep that in mind. When you come to New York, Chef Paul's not here. We're going to have him sponsor a dinner where we serve all the foods you ate. So the horse stomach main course. We'll have a blood milk martini. But this has been incredibly enlightening and very educational. And we really thank you for being on. And we'll definitely tune into the show. And check out some more stuff. So,
but it was an honor to have just such an amazing year, and we hope to have more. And I'm glad you guys are appreciating the show.
All right, man. Thanks so much. Hazen Nordell, Surviving the Tribe on Nat Geo. Catch it. Thank you, Crazy Legs Conte.
Horse butter stomach.
And I am the Rev Spiro. The Chef Paul isn't here, but that is another episode of Eating Disorder. Thank you so much.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.